I sell all that land and I made over $90,000 cash. I go to my wife and she's pregnant. I said, honey, I'm going to quit my job and become a full-time land investor. And she said, absolutely not. So it took about 18 months for land investing income to exceed the investment banking income. So I'd made $100,000. But when I factored in my time flying back and forth, it was the first time I really broke even.
One of the most important things I've learned in my life is that a person can achieve all their goals, they can be wealthy and still not be fully free. As I climbed the wealth ladder and grew a company that was one of the most successful real estate investment companies of its kind here in St. Louis, Missouri, on the outside, I had everything I had dreamed of. The beautiful wife, nicer car than I thought I'd drive, nicer home, beautiful kids. And yet on the inside, I didn't really feel any different. I still felt, quite frankly, like a slave. I was chasing money. I was chasing my next goal. And when I hit the goal, I wouldn't take the time to celebrate it. And I didn't know how to fully enjoy the journey along the way. So as I've aged, I've gotten curious, how do we make our entire lives wealthy and not just one component of it? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to interview the guests on this show. And yeah, we're going to talk about what they've done and what their stories are and how they've become financially wealthy. But also, I want to dig into their relationship with money and their relationships with other and if they have more joy and fulfillment than when they started out, or if they don't, and why or why not. So thanks for tuning in. We got a great guest coming for you. Let's get started. Hey guys, Jim Manning here with another episode of the Passive Wealth Show. And today it is my pleasure to have the Mark Podolsky, also known as the Land Geek, on the line. So we're going to talk about land and then also, goodness, whatever else comes to our minds here. So welcome, Mark. Glad to have you. And thanks for coming on the show, man.
Jim Manning, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So, Mark, let's do the old background. Tell us kind of about yourself and how you ended up getting into real estate investing.
Yeah. So if we rewind the tape to 2000, I was a miserable, micromanaged, 45-minute commute to work and back investment banker, specializing in mergers and acquisitions with private equity groups. And Jim, it got so bad for me. I wouldn't get the Sunday blues anticipating Monday coming around. I'd get the Friday blues anticipating the weekend going by really fast and having to be back at work on Monday. So my firm hires this guy and he's telling me that as a side hustle, he's going to tax deed auctions. He's buying up raw land, pennies on the dollar. He's flipping them online and he's making a 300% return on his investment. And Jim, I'm looking at companies all day long. Great company, great. Has 15% EBITDA margins or free cash flow. Average company's 10%. I'm looking at companies all day long, less than 10%. So of course, I don't believe him. So I've got $3,000 saved up for car repairs. I go to New Mexico with him. I do exactly what he tells me to do. I buy 10 half-acre parcels at an average price of $300 each. I flip them online and they all sell for an average price of $1,200 each, 300%, it worked. So I took all that money, I went to another auction, and this is in Arizona, which is where I live. And again, it's 2000, there's no one in the room, and I'm buying up lots and acreage for nothing. I sell all that land, and I made over $90,000 cash. So I go to my wife, and she's pregnant. I said, honey, I'm going to quit my job and become a full-time land investor. And she said, absolutely not. So I said, okay. So it took about 18 months for land investing income to exceed the investment banking income. And then I quit, and I've been doing it full-time ever since. I've done over 6,000 transactions and counting, and absolutely love the business and the model.
So what's in the name, Land Geek? Like, do you just consider yourself a big old geek, or like,
I am a geek. I like nerdy things, geeky things, systems, processes, automation, AI, software, Star Wars, Star Trek, Lord of the Rings. Yeah, like all that stuff. So, if we were friends in high school, we'd be like, yeah, he's with the geeky kids.
So we totally would have been friends. I mean, we grew up 5 minutes apart. We just weren't quite in the, Mark looks younger than me, but he's got me by a little bit. So we didn't cross.
grew up really pretty close to each other. So, okay. So then the land thing started off, and were you ever tempted to get into other real estate investing strategies, or has this one just gone so well for you that you've just kind of doubled down on this niche?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a inch wide and a mile deep. I tried once, I think it was 2005, to flip a house. And after we made money, I mean, you know, it was at the height of that market. But when I started factoring in my time and meeting the subs and checking on the house and watering the plants, driving back and forth, dealing with the realtor, I actually felt like I broke even on that deal. And so it wasn't for me at all. So I like the idea of not having to deal with anything physical, having a system, and, you know, kind of shuffling paper and making money.
Gotcha. So 6,000 deals. Congratulations. That is not a small feat. So walk me through like a deal that has gone bad for you that you didn't.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to.
What are some of the risk factors in land investing for us to be aware of?
Yeah. I mean, it might be a good place to start if I just give you the model and kind of walk you through it and then answer like, okay, here's what a bad deal would look like for me. Because a bad deal, because we're making our money on the buy, is a little tricky in the land business, where we don't have to deal with other issues like in, you know, a physical structure. So Jim, you're in St. Louis, and I'm going to assume that you own 5 acres of raw land in Colorado and you owe $200 in back taxes. So you're advertising two important things to me. Number one, you have no emotional attachment to the raw land. You're in Missouri, properties in Colorado. And number two, you're distressed financially in some weird way, because when we don't pay for things like our property taxes, we don't value them in the same way. As a result, the county treasurer keep sending you notices saying, Jim, you don't pay your property taxes, you're going to lose that property to a tax deed or a tax lien investor. So all I'm going to do is look at the comparable sales in your 5-acre parcel for the last 12 to 18 months. I'm going to take the lowest comparable sale, let's say it's $10,000, and divide by 4. And that would get me what Warren Buffett would call a 300% margin of safety. So I send you an actual offer of $2,500. Now, you accept it. Why? Because for you, $2,500 is better than nothing. In reality, 3 to 5% of people will accept my quote unquote top dollar offer. But now that you've accepted it, I have to go through due diligence or in-depth research. I have to confirm you still own the property. I have to make sure the back taxes are only $200. I have to make sure there's been no breaks in the chain of title, no liens or encumbrances. And so I have this entire property report checklist I give to my team in Jamaica. They're connected to an American Title Company, and they'll run the report for me. It costs like $11. Now, if it was more than $5,000, I wouldn't take any title risk, and I would just close traditionally through a title company. But this is only $2,500. So I go ahead, everything checks out. I send you a check for $2,300. I send the treasurer a check for $200. I own it free and clear. And now I'm going to sell it 30 days or less, and I'm going to make a cash flow like a rental home. So Jim, I have a built-in best buyer. Do you know who it is?
Do I know who it is? The built-in best buyer. No.
Who's going to buy that land? The neighbors. So I'm going to send out neighbor letters saying, here's your opportunity, protect your privacy, protect your views, know your neighbor. Now, if the neighbors pass, I'll go to my buyer's list. The buyer's list passes, I'll go to a little website you may have heard of. It's called Meta or Facebook, buy sell groups, the marketplace. And then I'll go to the lands, land.com, landmoto.com, landandfarm.com, landsofamerica.com. These are platforms where people buy and sell raw land. But the secret is in the pricing. So all I'm going to ask for is a $2,500 down payment. And then I'll just make it a car payment. Let's say $197 a month at 9% interest for the next 60 months. So it's a one-time sale. I'm going to get my money out on the down payment. I could go 6 to 10 months out. And now I'm going to get $197 a month at 9% interest for the next 60 months. Jim, no renters, no rehabs, no renovations, no rodents. And because I'm not dealing with a tenant, I'm exempt from Dodd-Frank, RESPA, and the SAFE Act, all this onerous real estate legislation. So then it's a simple game. Can we create enough land notes where our passive income exceeds our fixed expenses, and then we're working because we want to, not because we have to.
I love that. Did you end up getting mentored or taking on a mentor when you first started, like the guy that was working there already, or did you just kind of get in, figure this out all on your own, or
what? Yeah, I made lots of mistakes, lots and lots of mistakes. So, you know, he was starting just a little ahead of me, so he didn't know any more than I did, really. So we were kind of just doing it together. And what happened was, I thought, well, I'm doing great. I've got a nice business here, and I'm flipping land for cash. And I realized, wait, this is a hustle. Like, the cash is great, but every time I close another property, another deal, I got to find another deal to replenish my inventory. I've got a family, I got a wife that doesn't work. I got responsibilities. Like, this is stressful. So I figured, well, if I just sell it one time and I can make a cash flow, and if they default, there's no cost of foreclosure because I'm using a land sale contract. Well, that seems like a better model. And if I need cash, I can always sell the notes at a discount. I can raise money, or I can flip again for cash. So I have options for capital. And so that's really what I did. And really, I, you know, 95% of my deals now are all for on owner terms. I really like the mailbox money and the monthly recurring revenue on that system.
Yeah. When you get far enough ahead, then it becomes a better thing to also delay the taxes that are owed too, right?
Well, the tax situation is interesting because I'm a dealer in land. So I don't get any tax benefits in that sense. Now, if I were using it through a self-directed vehicle like an IRA or a Roth, then I could get those returns tax-free or tax-deferred. But because it's, you know, I'm in the full-time business of buying and selling raw land, I'm a dealer. But what's interesting is that I don't have to take the entire price. Let's say I sell a piece of land for $35,000. I don't have to do the, you know, even though I'm only getting 10, you know, payments or whatever, you know, whatever they are, like, I don't have to pay the full tax on $35,000 like a car dealer.
That's what I was getting at. If you have that $30,000 profit or whatever it is when you owner finance, like if you sold it outright with, and they gave you cash for it, well, you owe taxes on the $30,000 profit. But if you owner finance it, you only owe taxes on the money that you've received and any principal payments. So you could even give an interest only loan, and then you're paying taxes on the interest, but you're not necessarily paying capital gains on that deal, right? So Mark's kind of nodding his head.
Exactly.
And the owner financing structure works whether you can do that with housing too. We've done that a lot of owner finance deals on our team.
You have to make sure you have a good CPA that understands that loophole in the tax code, because some CPA was like, wait, no, you're a dealer, you got to pay the full tax, even though you've only collected $1,000.
That's right. Yeah. And there's a tax code line for it. Oh man. I always forget this when this comes up on what the line is. I'll see if I can find it while we continue the conversation. Maybe we can go back. I know I got it in my notes somewhere, but okay. So you started out doing this, and let's keep going on like your investment journey.
I mean, let's talk about the worst. Let's talk about the worst deal.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do that.
So the worst deal I ever did was in a area of Western Pennsylvania called Treasure Lake. And so this was a overdeveloped community by about 1,000 lots. So these lots had liens on them from the Property Owners Association, and the lot owners stopped paying their property taxes. They stopped paying their Property Owners Association fees because they weren't going out there to build. But I fell in love with this community. They had 3 PGA-rated golf courses. They had lakes. They had million-dollar homes. It was gated. There was a restaurant. I mean, it was a real nice community. The wealthy people in that area, you know, university professors, the doctors and lawyers, they lived in this community. And so I thought, oh, this is great. I'm going to go in and I'm going to negotiate with the Property Owners Association and with the county. So I got my suit on. I flew out to Pennsylvania and I said, look, you've got dead money here and I'm here to resurrect it and I'm going to make it live again. So all you have to do is deed over those 1,000 lots to me. And while I own the property, I don't have to pay any fees or taxes, but I'll sell the property for you. I'll get you a new buyer who's going to pay those fees, pay those taxes. And, you know, they say, okay, great. Then just, you know, buy them from us for $50 a lot. I'm like, great, $50 a lot. I'll take all 1,000. So this is in 2005 that I'm negotiating. You would think this would be a slam dunk deal, but no, the people in the POA, the golfers, we're like, we don't want him selling these lots because we're not going to get our tee times. And then the boaters are like, we don't want him selling these lots. We're going to have too many people in the lake. Who are these 1,000 people that are going to come into our community? And so I had to negotiate and I had to negotiate. And basically it was like the house deal. So I'd made $100,000, but when I factored in my time flying back and forth, it was the first time I really broke even on a deal and on my time. Because what happened was I started making money in 2006, 2007, things started to slow. And then 2008, I couldn't give these properties away. Nobody was buying. And if I had had a mentor, they would have told me, well, why don't you just take these down 10 at a time, 5 at a time? Why are you taking off 1,000 lots in that responsibility? Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know what I didn't know. I had a little bit of hubris or a lot of hubris. And that was the worst deal I ever did because it was the first time in business I couldn't keep my word. I had to give back those lots.
Yeah, and 1,000 lots. I mean, that's like, you know, as entrepreneurs, a lot of times we go after like opportunities in front of us and not realizing that some opportunities make you say no to a lot of other opportunities, right?
Exactly.
A 1,000 lot deal. I mean, that's like, okay, hello, your next 2 years of work.
Like, yeah.
What you're doing, you know,
right.
You don't necessarily think like, oh, wow, this is me saying now no to so many other deals that I could do and what could I have made on those other opportunities. Right. And we've talked, Mark and I have talked about this before. Mark has an outstanding podcast as well. Thanks for having me on that, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
How we, sometimes can go after a little bit, more than what we should. And, you know, I have a friend that had everything set up, all the passive income in the world, and she went after a hotel. So she had over 300 single family rentals and had already won the game, but she didn't define what the game was. Mm-hmm. Buys a hotel, and then the hotel, that deal goes sideways and she loses everything.
Yeah.
And
never cross collateralize.
Yeah. And it's, so sometimes it's all about, hey, how do we get crystal clear on what we're going after and what opportunities we should just say no to that maybe aren't in our wheelhouse. So you've done, I mean, I'm impressed by your focus, man, that it's really been, it's 6,000 land deals and one flip. Come on.
Yeah. Marcus. One housing flip. Yeah. So that was
really you've been truly that focused.
I've been truly that focused because, I really had a mentor help me with this because I would get shiny object syndrome and I had shiny object syndrome. So I went, I met this guy out here in Scottsdale, who's really big into the commercial space, and he buys strip centers and he owns lots of strip centers. He's a multimillionaire. And, you know, what we were talking about real estate and our niches. And I said, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, doing mobile home parks and buying mobile home parks. He's like, interesting. Tell me more. So, well, you know, it's not too far stretch from what I'm doing. I get depreciation. And he's like, okay. He's like, I love when people come to me and they say they want to get into my strip center niche. And I'm like, why do you say that? He's because they think that it's so easy. He's like, this is all I do day in and day out. He's like, if they come into my market, there's a reason they're seeing that deal. It's because I passed on it. He's like, why on earth do you think you have any advantage in the mobile home space if you've been spending all this time in your land niche? He's like, why wouldn't you just keep doing what you have an advantage in? I'm like, oh yeah, you're absolutely right. So of course he was right, because focus is so important, especially in real estate. And it reminded me that, yeah, there's, you know, when you have an advantage, take advantage of it. If you have no advantage, you've got to start looking for ways to find it. And you've got to start somewhere for sure. But if you already have one, why would you discount it?
Yeah. And how do you double down and make it more profitable?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, all right. So then let's keep going on your story, man. So things are going good enough. You're able to get your wife to agree to do this crazy land thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then was it all smooth sailing? Did you run into any hiccups along the way? Let's keep going on your story, man.
Yeah. So 2010 rolls around and I've got all these land notes and people were calling me saying, Mark, it's between food and this land note. I'm choosing food, as everybody's, you know, losing their job, the financial insecurity of that great recession. I really didn't get hit till 2010, but about 50% of my notes portfolio just goes away. And so I'm dealing with this huge loss of income. Now the company's still profitable, but I've now built myself quite the treadmill, because I had a big house, I had a big mortgage, I had nice cars, fancy vacations, 3 kids, nanny, housekeeper. And so I had built this very egoic driven lifestyle. And then suddenly reality hits and it's like, I can't, you know, I just lost 50% of my income. This is stressful. And so I started whittling down all of those things and started seeing like, holy cow, I'm way happier with less. And really that sort of that kick to the head, that ego kick is exactly what I needed at that time to really start going on a different journey and really thinking about the things that are most important to me in life and how do I create a lifestyle that is driven by that. Because big cars and big homes and fancy vacations are great. There's nothing wrong with them, but they don't make you happy. And so I realized a simpler life for me actually made me happier. And actually I was buying time to spend more time with my kids and actually deepen those relationships and deepen the relationships with my friends and family. Now, of course I say that in 2020, I get divorced, but it wasn't for a lack of effort. It wasn't because I was chasing things or possessions or, you know, egoically. It was just, relationships are tough and you either grow together or you separate.
So when you lost the income, walk me through just like a specific deal on how, on what happened, on the dynamics of that deal. And then that way I can wrap my head around it a little bit more. So,
yeah. So imagine you're paying me $197 a month on a note, and then you can't pay me anymore. Well, then I've lost that income temporarily until I resell that property. And so when it happens in a big bunch, then you need to manage your cash flow. Now, the comeback is fantastic because my cost basis is lower. And now when I'm reselling it, fantastic, right? I've increased my ROI. But at that time, I'd never gone through any type of dip. And so today I use a Mike Michalowicz profit first system to manage that cash flow and have, you know, little buckets so that, you know, we're due for another big recession, that, you know, world be on sale and I can go out and buy again and have that cash.
Gotcha. So it was really more, so the deal itself didn't get put in jeopardy, or I guess only would if you didn't have money to pay for the taxes for it, but.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
If you didn't have the funds and you would have to let go of it, but.
I just had to whittle down my personal expenses.
And then also in that environment, like, did it take you a couple of years to then get back to the same income level? Like, was it slow going to find other people?
Like, yeah, it took about 24 months. I'd say by 2012, I was stabilized.
Okay. So now 2012 rolled around. You realize, hey, I'm happier with less stuff. My goodness, I'm making the same income that I was before. And like what happened next, man?
So basically, I just started doing more of what I've been doing, but really operationalizing it and really treating it more like a business than a lifestyle business. And so really being just vicious with the time that I had so that I could get myself out of the business. So creating systems and processes, automations, software, so that today 90% of the business is automated with inexpensive virtual assistants and software. And really building that to a point where I could just be the CEO and looking at the numbers, working with team, really scaling a land business.
Gotcha. So then what did your deal flow look like? Have you looked at your numbers? So you said you've done the 6,000. How many of those deals have came in the last, so 6,000 since 2005? I'm sorry, is that?
No, since 2001.
2001. Okay, yeah. So like first decade, how many deals had you done compared to like your last decade?
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't want to give you throw a number out there. I really don't know. But I'd say the goal today is we want to do a deal a day. So we want to buy a piece of property, we sell a piece of property every day. So 365 deals.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we've done about 3,500, or we're close. We've done over 3,500. I'm not sure exactly where the board is at now, but what I found too on our journey is that it started out slow and then kind of that was that snowball effect. And then now we're obviously doing a lot more, but also have like a really big team. It's not just like me doing things, right? It's an entire organization that's doing it day in and day out, full-time people. So then you systematized it and you created a land where you, when did Land Geek come around?
So Land Geek started around 2012, 2011, somewhere around there. And a guy called me out of the blue and he saw my website. He's like, I want you to teach me what you do. And I'm like, I don't teach this. I remember I was on vacation in San Jose with my family. And I remember picking the cell phone and be like, no, I don't teach this. And then he's like, what if I pay you this? I'm like, oh, okay. I'm like, that's interesting. So I said to my wife, my ex-wife, she's like, why would you teach anybody this? She's like, you're gonna create your own competition. I'm like, yeah, that's a good point. Why don't we do some math and just see, well, how big is this market? And so I put on my investment banker hat and the market is billions of acres of raw land available. And there's no private equity groups. There's no hedge funds. There's no big money in it. And so a million people can be in this niche and we'll all run out of money before we run out of deal flow. Now, what's interesting about the land niche is that it's so boring that all the other real estate niches are way more sexy. So if you go on the HGTV or DIY network, you're never going to see me on Flip This Land. The before pictures are all land. The after pictures are all land. It's boring. And if you go to a real estate investment association meeting, you know, 99% of them are going to be landlords, wholesalers, and flippers. You and I might be the only land guys in that room.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know if we've done about everything in single family real estate. It was not, as I think back at it, it wasn't even on our radar that land was something to do or concentrate on at all. So that, I mean, that does make sense in my experience too. Like people just don't talk about it and do it as much. I have a feeling it's a lot more competitive now than it used to be. How does the competition look like today compared to back in the day when you started?
Yeah. I mean, I think that a rising tide lifts all boats. So it wouldn't be good if I were the only one doing it, for sure. So Pepsi needs Coke, Coke needs Pepsi. So, you know, I definitely know that in certain land niches, so for the people that are going after the bigger flips, so they're looking for properties an hour outside of the city, and they'll buy it for $30,000 and they'll flip it for $60,000 with a realtor, that market has gotten very competitive. My niche, not so much. I mean, it's not that there aren't more people doing it, but I think that it's not as interesting to most people compared to that niche. And so, you know, to get a river of nickels takes a lot more work, a lot more time, and again, is just not as sexy.
But it can really add up.
It really adds up. Yeah.
So where do you see yourself going with this thing, man? Like, is Land Geek going to be in worldwide with students all over the place let's talk a little bit about that. Yeah.
And Land Geek. I mean, I think, you know, for me, I really like freedom. So I want to work when I want, where I want, with whom I want. And so, and also just the knowledge of how much is enough. So I wouldn't say that I want to have this worldwide coaching enterprise. I definitely want to help as many people as I can help and transform as many lives as I can transform, because I do think that when you help people solve their money and their time problems, they can move up Maslow's hierarchy of needs into self-actualization and really do and find their greatest purpose and have the energy and resources and time to do that. But for me personally, I think that I'm really interested more in solving all the pain points for people as well in the business. So I've got two software programs that do that. You know, we've created sort of this mini economy. There's virtual assistants out there, ready-made. There's, you know, all types of just resources now that are available before I started. And I want to just continue sort of being that flywheel and helping people, you know, solve that. But as far as like my own personal ambition, I'm not sure. You know, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And as long as I'm enjoying what I'm doing, I never see myself retiring, and certainly want to keep growing my own land business and helping people as well.
How many students do you have now that you're working with?
I don't know. You'd think I would know these things. I don't know, but if I had to guess, hundreds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. That's fantastic. What would you give yourself? If you had to tell yourself something like an actionable piece of advice, like when you were just starting out, like what would it be, man?
Get a mentor, because I think having that mentor has been invaluable. And somebody who's, you can sort of smart cut the process. They've made the mistakes. They've had the road rash. You don't have to make those same mistakes. I think is the best thing that I could have done for myself when I first started, but I didn't know what I didn't know. And really being relatively successful out of the gate probably hurt me rather than helped me, because I didn't think I needed to ask for help. I'm like, oh, I'm doing pretty well.
Interesting. So like the out of the gate success hurt your long-term growth.
Yeah. I mean, I built this great job for myself and didn't know I was even doing it. I was just so busy and had so much energy after coming out of the investment banking job. I'm like, well, I can make my own hours. I'm my own boss. And then I had a mentor and he said, no, what you have is a better job. He's like, a business is something that grows beyond you. He's like, when Steve Jobs died, Apple, you know, will continue to operate. And he's mm-hmm. right. But if I was, you know, if I died, my family would be in a lot of trouble at that time, except for, of course, the life insurance.
And LandGeek would not ever have gotten off the ground.
LandGeek would not have gotten off the ground.
It would have been no LandGeek. A travesty that would have been. Oh, that's great. So, and then going forward, it sounds like you're just enjoying life and wanted to do more of the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then there's no properties for this geek either, right? Like it's just the land geek. There's no crazy branches out.
Just the land geek. There's no, you know, single family home geek.
So there's a lot of power behind that, guys. I heard this story one time about Bill Gates and a couple of his buddies. They're all sitting around a table and a guy comes up and says, hey, what's the secret to your guys' success? And the three billionaires all look at them and say, focus, focus. And we see these Amazons of the world, like whether it's Amazon or some of these other big corporations that are, how many, like Amazon has like 1,000 businesses now in it. Like, I have no idea. I mean, it's certainly crazy what they've been able to accomplish. But as entrepreneurs, like they only did one thing for several years. Mark, pop quiz question on Amazon. Do you know what business did they start out on? What were they doing on?
My guess is it was selling books.
Boom, you got it. They sold books for a couple of years, guys. And then they did something crazy. They got another product. And that other product was CDs, very related to books. And then they did CDs for another year. And then they started branching out as they developed that core competency. And it can be so confusing looking at all these other organizations and conglomerates and everything that they're doing. Well, they're not, you know, it's very rare for an organization to try and do four things at once and then become anything. Most of the time in small business, you go out and do those four things at once and then you kind of are okay at all of them. Whereas if you master one thing, get really good at it, and then start to branch out, that's when the magic can happen, right? So, Mark, it's really smart, man.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, we actually teach that as well. We call it the beachhead strategy, where you start out just in one county when you start this business. So many times that people are like, I'm going to start in 10 counties. Like, no, just find your beachhead, start there, and then expand out. And to your point, even Uber started on one street, and then it became one block, and then, you know, grew from there.
Then it became the world.
And then, yeah, then the world. So, you know, but you're right. Like, you have to start just ultra focused on getting really good at that one thing before you expand out.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Mark, thanks for coming on, man. If people want to get a hold of you, what is the best way? And then also tell us about this book that you have.
Yeah, the best way to get a hold of me is just thelandgeek.com. And if they want to hear our interview on the Art of Passive Income podcast, they can find it there as well on thelandgeek.com. And then for your listeners, I have a special link for them, and they can go ahead and get Dirt Rich, the book. It talks more about my story and the model, and they can get it for free, just pay shipping. And I have a link to that.
Yeah, so we'll put that in the show notes on the passivewealthshow.com. We'll have that link in there. And Mark, thanks for coming on. So nice to this podcast world. You never know who you're going to meet. So Mark and I met through a mutual friend, and turns out we grew up 5 minutes apart. But you don't live in St. Louis anymore, unfortunately. But hey, you know, that's cool. So I'm glad to have met you and excited for you and your future and how you're helping people. Congrats on the success and excited for you for what's to come.
Thanks, Jim. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys. Well, that's a wrap on this episode of the Passive Wealth Show. Don't be a stranger. Make sure you tune into our next episode. We appreciate you. Thank you. And we will see you next time.
All right, guys, that's a wrap. Thanks so much for tuning in. We have a website, passivewealthshow.com, where you can get more great content and resources. We offer a passive profit strategy session, and you can find that on our website as well, where we'll basically ask you a bunch of discovery questions and help you figure out if investing passively is a good thing for you or not. So go to our website, passivewealthshow.com, and we'll go from there.